I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture in film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher. We're currently introducing the small person in my life to the original Muppet movies. They are seven and very particular about their entertainment requirements. I mean, look who they're being raised by. For New Year's, we watched The Great Muppet Caper. Would a kid raised on modern children's bright colors and lightning pace and constant pop culture references be into a 70s caper movie with puppets? Well, at the climax, when Miss Piggy crashes into the Mallory Gallery on a motorbike, they literally stood up, popcorn flying everywhere, raised both fists into the sky, and screamed, "Let's do this, Miss Piggy!" I was so moved, I actually started to cry. And as much as the small one loves Miss Piggy, their favorite Muppet is Animal. We are very big on chaotic good characters. So we decided to show them the real rock star that Animal was allegedly based on. And in 1967, The Who appeared on the Smothers Brothers variety show. I believe this was their first American appearance. And if you haven't seen the clip, it is essential viewing because it's Roger Daltrey doing his mic tricks and he's singing My Generation and he means it because he is in that generation. It's Pete Townshend in a frilly cravat and essentially liquid tight pants and he's just bouncing all over the place while playing the guitar, and then of course he destroys it at the end. And finally, it is Keith Moon playing like a mofo and then ending his set by blowing up his drum kit with double the amount of explosives that he usually did. The band dives for cover, Townshend has his hair singed, and Keith Moon had shrapnel in his arm by the end of it. The small one said in this tiny, hushed voice after all that went down, "That's rock and roll." And they are not wrong. And we will eventually discuss with them the perils of rockstar excess. But for now, it's amazing that 54 years later, those stage antics are still just as effective. Now, both our movies today involve The Who, or people from The Who, and a whole lot of antics. But before we start, what was going on that allowed these destructive weirdos anywhere near not one, but two large budget feature films in the same year?
Keith Moon, to me, to connect to another Muppet, I think has a bit of Crazy Harry in him. Crazy Harry was the Muppet you might not know by name, but he's the one who just dynamited everything on the Muppet Show. Yeah. And there's like a certain energy there that I've always thought of, like, Keith Moon is a bit of Animal and a bit of Crazy Harry. Cam, over to you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird time for rock and roll. We talked a bit about in our 1978 episodes that rock was kind of in a weird place. A lot of people thought that rock and roll was like a thing that came and was going potentially. Mm-hmm. Specifically when it came to The Who by 1975, they were essentially on the cusp of retirement, semi-retirement from touring at least. What they were experiencing what we would now call a burnout. Mm-hmm. They essentially, so Tommy the Album had been released in 1969, a rapturous reception. People loved it. It was kind of, you know, it's not the first rock opera, but was considered that as a concept. People just loved a single kind of cohesive concept album from a band. They toured the hell out of that, and their tour went immediately into Quadrophenia in 1973.
Jesus. Yeah, that's crazy when you think about that.
Which is crazy. And also kind of fascinating now in the breadth of time, they hated Quadrophenia. Pretty much every interview I'm sure that all of us read at the time, they just thought it was junk.
And it's not made into a film until 79, right?
Yeah. So that's kind of their comeback after retirement. But yeah, they weren't pleased with it. I think that there was concerns that it was getting too far from rock and roll. There's a lot of synth. It's kind of fascinating because they're a band who, I guess, was constantly told that they're about to break up. So it was always a weird thing. And they were really never about to break up. So you get the impression that Pete Townsend was really over it. And Roger Daltrey knew that the best way to preserve the band was to, like, not push him anymore and allow everybody to do solo stuff. So Roger Daltrey was doing solo stuff at the time, but with no intention of ever stopping doing The Who.
I feel like every interview I read with Roger Daltrey was just him being deeply defensive, every second sentence being like, no, we're not breaking up. We're still together. Yeah. Everything's fine. Pete's okay.
Yes. Though at the same time, I'm shocked about how candid they are about doing bad shows, essentially. Like, I don't think people thought they were bad shows. They were actually selling out and breaking records constantly. I think they broke a record in North America and in the UK at the Isle of Wight, like right before Tommy, but like it's fascinating to see him in writing be like, we aren't playing very well live. Like that was essentially what they decided. They never broke up, but what they decided was to cease live playing, just to kind of like regain their creative juices. And part of their like transition to that was to do movies, to kind of follow their careers. I think Roger Daltrey was a bit more interested in being a movie star than any of the rest of them. Except for maybe Keith Moon, which we never really got to find out because, of course, part of their retirement, which never came back, was Keith Moon died a couple years after 1975. So, it's this kind of fascinating time where maybe rock and roll was dying and maybe they had to figure out something new. I think they just thought that they needed different creative outlets, and film seemed like a great opportunity.
And film was going super counterculture at this point. So that makes sense to me, whereas, you know, I think the counterculture is kind of over by 78, like when we talked about Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which is produced by the same person as Tommy, Robert Stigwood. But like 75 is really like, it's a counterculture year for sure.
Oh, yeah. I also think that like it's impossible as a modern person to imagine the album Tommy divorced from the movie.
It's true.
And like, I don't think Pete Townsend, I can't imagine he's getting across his narrative in just the album. You know, it's such a bizarre and complicated narrative that it, to me, requires the visuals to make sense of it. Just a series of songs would be very hard to figure out.
Totally. But before we get into that, let's give a little bit of context here from where Tommy was coming from. So John Lennon declared that the Beatles were bigger than Jesus in 1966. And in the mid to late 60s, Clapton is God graffiti started popping up all over London. People still don't know who did that. And the musician as a messiah is pretty well trodden ground. I'm sure when you get big enough with thousands of fans screaming in front of you nightly, telling you that they love you, it must be hard to not let it at least cross your mind that you're something special. And you may not realize what the consequences of your actions could be if it all goes wrong. There's a great story that Elton John tells when he was being interviewed on ABC at the premiere of Tommy that kind of shows how dangerous this kind of thinking can be. So at one of his concerts, he saw a security person assault a fan who was getting too close. They were trying to take a picture, so the security guard grabbed them, tossed them, smashed the camera, and really hurt the person. Elton saw red, jumped off the stage, and proceeded to chase the security guard out of the building. And then when he came back, he demanded all security be removed before he continued playing. And then when the security guards left, he announced, "This is your show. Come as close as you want." This venue held 14,000 people, and they proceeded to do exactly that.
That's just irresponsible.
Yeah. Now, fortunately, no one was hurt, but Elton reflected on what a very bad situation that could have been. Making bad choices on a power trip. Isn't that kind of what Tommy is all about? I don't know. Seems like one of those things you can lay any interpretation you want on it.
Mm-hmm.
Cam, do you want to give us a little plot summary?
I mean, okay. It's a kind of a long and complicated story, but basically, Tommy is a young boy. He's born at the end of World War One, his father goes off in World War Two. He is lost. His mother takes up with another guy. Suddenly, his father reappears. This guy murders his father. Tommy witnesses it. Then, due to trauma, he psychosomatically goes deaf, blind, and mute. Then it's kind of his travails as a person who is like that, which includes a lot of abuse from various people in his life. He eventually finds pinball is his one release, the ability to feel the ball. He's exceptionally good at pinball. Eventually, that makes him very rich and famous, and he eventually regains the power of speech and sight, and he becomes essentially a messiah, and eventually his followers turn on him as well.
That also frees him at the very end as well, sure. Doesn't it? Like, it's kind of like this weird pursuit for freedom.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole thing is a very weird religious allegory. A lot of it's based on the teachings of various gurus. The big one, Pete Townsend's this is all mostly written by Pete Townsend with the exception of a couple songs. It's a lot based on the teachings of his personal guru, Meher Baba, who is a guy who took a oath of silence for 44 years. He was not deaf or blind or mute. He just chose to be. But he believed that the whole world was like imaginary, and it's kind of like escaping the cycle of reincarnation and abuse. It's very fascinating. There's like the teachings of Marshall McLuhan are in there, because that's like vibration is the best kind of communication. The touch is the purest form of communication. Take what you will from it. I think that's kind of Pete Townsend's feelings. It's just like presenting a bunch of stuff. And that's not even mentioning Ken Russell, who throws in the craziest imagery of all time. Like, why is a church Marilyn Monroe? Like, you figure it out, man.
Well, and also to his credit, because like the original Tommy album is just The Who singing and performing those songs. You know, Acid Queen is a fine song when sung by them. And you get Tina Turner in there doing it. And you're like, oh, that's what it's supposed to sound like. I see.
Giving LSD to a child.
Yeah,
I mean, the Ken Russell connection, and this is the first time we've ever done an episode, and probably one of the only times where we're going to do an episode where both films are directed by the same person in the same year. So think about that. Like, this is 1975. Mm-hmm. Ken Russell has two films that are released theatrically, starring Roger Daltrey with songs by The Who. The second one we'll talk about is a little bit different. But for those of our listeners who don't know Ken Russell, wow, he is a complex character.
That's putting it lightly. Yes. Yeah. Interesting human being.
He's been called the thinking man's stoner director, which I think is accurate. And, you know, by 1975, he was a pretty well-known figure. He's British. Thinking about British film in the 60s and 70s, he's one of those very few directors that really allowed English film to graduate kind of from the kitchen sink drama, like very melodramatic, realist films, to full-blown, like, grandiose misanthropy and adultery. And really, really, he's like, him and Robert Stigwood, especially as the producer, kind of brought that to the forefront.
Well, taking it also from that level up, from that like wink, wink, nudge, nudge, know what I mean? Sort of like, oh, it's a busty woman and she bends over, and like that sort of level of comedy into something totally different.
Yeah, that's a good point. And also bringing, you know, people like Eric Clapton and I think Keith Moon was always a comedian in some ways, but bringing rock stars that are not known for their comedy or for their film performances into this foray is really interesting. He's someone who converted to Catholicism in the 1950s. He was not born Catholic, and I think this is pretty unusual, you know, in religious history. And so he was always obsessed with these kinds of religious figures. If you look at his filmography before Tommy and Litzomania, which we're going to talk about next, this is not the first time he's made a film about an obsessive relationship between the public and a musical figure. He had biopics, or loose biopics, on Debussy, on Tchaikovsky at this point, on Gustav Mahler. He was working even on one for Isadora Duncan, who was a dancer and choreographer. This kind of like 19th century, 18th century, even early 20th century performance is what he was obsessed with. And Tommy, as well as Litzomania, is peppered throughout with all of these like religious symbols. And I can see how Catholics probably found this very upsetting, I would assume. I've never personally read, you know, because the Catholic Church, of course, is always protesting films, and very much so still in the 1970s. I imagine this broke them at a certain point. But, you know, like in Litzomania, you have Ringo Starr as the Pope. In Tommy, as I mentioned, you have Eric Clapton as this like high priest. And it's a great scene where he's surrounded by all these statues, these very grotesque statues of Marilyn Monroe. So you kind of get this like rock and roll 1950s vibe. Leave it to Ken Russell to cast someone like Keith Moon as Uncle Ernie, probably the most concerning character in this film, molests Tommy. And then you have Cousin Kevin, played by Paul Nicholas, is kind of the MVP for me in these two films.
He's amazing in everything he does. He's one of those guys. He seems like someone who, like, they're like, oh, the person we wanted fell through. What's Paul Nicholas doing? Let's get Paul Nicholas. And he comes in and just knocks it out of the park. Like, yeah, he's a cleanup hitter.
I wasn't super familiar with him. When I Googled him and looked at his, like, face, you know, as he aged, I was like, oh, right, that guy. He plays, we'll talk about him in Litzomania because he's incredible. But he plays Cousin Kevin here. Pretty sure Cousin Kevin and Uncle Ernie are likely related. He's this kind of sadist biker band who also a guy who also abuses Tommy, and then Anne fucking Margaret as Tommy's mom, which I'm conflicted about. Like, so she was nominated for an Academy Award for this film. She won the Golden Globe for this film. I think she's amazing. A lot of the reviews I read and a lot of the almost more contemporary critiques to today of Tommy really criticize her. I don't quite get why. I think it's a difficult, first of all, this is a film that's entirely sung. It's a proper opera. There's very little dialogue. You also have Oliver Reed as his stepfather, who is not known for singing, but was known for doing, like, The Devils with Ken Russell.
Oliver Reed at this point for me is like the Russell Crowe of the 60s and 70s.
I think he's better than that, though. I would say he's better than that. And so Anne Margaret, you know, being cast in this is, you know, she was known for singing. She had starred with Elvis. Think about Bye Bye Birdie, which I think is 1967, was like a really, you know, really huge hit for her. But this isn't like really her, like, her forte, I would say. And I think she's really good in it.
Which is weird. Ken Russell said that he cast her specifically because he wanted someone who could sing.
I think she can sing in this. I mean, I don't know.
It works for her.
It works. One thing I would probably bring up is in, I think it was just like 73, maybe 72, she had been catastrophically injured in a concert that she performed in. She fell off, some rafters collapsed, and she fell.
Whoa.
Broke her arm, shattered her jaw, and shattered her cheekbone, had her jaw wired for many, many months, really wasn't expected to recover or make a comeback in any way where she could sing. So with that in the context of this film, that's kind of interesting and something to keep in mind, because I do think she's really good. Can we talk about the baked beans?
Of course you can talk about the baked beans. And I still can't watch that without feeling incredibly nauseous.
So this has been described as Ken Russell's most commercial film, which is... says a lot when your most commercial film, and this film was in the top 10 in the box office, it was a big, big hit. When your most commercial film includes like a 7-minute sequence of Anne Margaret rolling around in an all white carpet full of baked beans, chocolate sauce, and bubbles in different stages, like not all at once, although at some point it gets all mixed in, you know something's gone horribly wrong in 1975.
And to hear her talk about doing that, she says it was a joyous experience. She said she had a lot of fun doing it, with the exception of the fact that apparently, because she throws a champagne bottle at a TV and then all this stuff explodes out of the television, there was still broken glass on the carpet and she didn't know that. And so as she's rolling around, she actually sliced her hand pretty badly and ended up having to get 23 stitches. But aside from that, she said it was great.
It is... I think, Cam, you saw this film before, long before I did, in preparing for the TV show. I remember you telling me about the baked beans scene, and I saved it because I was like, I'm really, really excited. And while watching it, I messaged him because it was like an hour and 20 minutes in, and I hadn't seen the baked beans scene yet. And I was worried that the file I was watching it had mysteriously been cut or something. And then and then it very much happens.
I mean, it's just a bunch of crazy sequences, essentially. Yeah, because that's like way late. Tommy's almost a messiah at that point. And it's, I mean, that's the thing is, like, this movie has so many kind of side roads
that aren't in the album.
A whole story for the mother. You get a whole story for the stepfather. You get a whole story for Uncle Ernie. Yeah.
And I think I read that, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I think you're more familiar with the album, probably both of you. In the rock opera, it's not the stepfather who murders the father who's returned home from the war. It's vice versa. So the father survives, murders his wife's lover, although the wife, I believe it's assumed he's dead. Like, he dies, he's an RAF, and he dies in combat. So it's like, it's really been switched around. So this film is actually giving Oliver Reed a huge part that does not exist in the rock opera whatsoever. Again, not a singer, I think, you know, he kind of speaks a lot of his lines, but he's so, he's just such a presence on film that it kind of works for me. Becky, I get the sense
well,
it doesn't.
That's why he was allowed to continue to do what he was doing, regardless of his antics and the severe alcoholism in his behavior. And it's because he was really something incredible and special. And who knows if he hadn't had a crippling addiction, what he would have been really capable of.
Yeah.
But I find it interesting in the relationship with him and Ken Russell is Ken Russell has a great quote saying, "You do not say cut to Oliver. You say, please, shall we stop filming now? Please, Oliver, have you anything further to say, Oliver?" Which I'm like, okay, that's got to be a set.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of these are also performances that are essentially silent performances, right? Because they were looping their songs later and stuff. Other than, I mean, obviously, the fascinating story is that Anne Margaret just came in one day and knocked out the entire film in one sitting, which is pretty amazing.
She's incredible.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that that's where Oliver Reed works, is the faces and stuff he makes. And I think that they all really find the level that Ken Russell wants. You get the impression, like, fascinating interviews with Roger Daltrey. Like, number one, there's an interview with Roger Daltrey where they make it sound so miserable, his on-set thing. There's just an interviewer talking to him, and in the 2 days they're there, they're like, they sprayed a whole pond's worth of water on him. They got him to jump out a window onto a mattress, and he missed the mattress and got a concussion something else. And he describes himself in that interview as the most expensive prop in cinema history. But the fact that he was like, "Hey, Ken, you want to make another movie?" makes you think that they all really clicked. Like, as wild, like, Ken Russell's a madman too.
Oh, God,
I mean,
he
was on Celebrity Big Brother. He's a guy who kind of never, like, I think his most commercial movie is Altered States, which is still pretty weird.
That's probably true. That's later.
It made less money than this, probably. But he's a guy who never stopped being Ken Russell, essentially. So I don't think he was necessarily a hugely easy guy to get along with.
No. Hugh Grant was on Marc Maron's podcast this month. For whatever reason, Marc Maron asked him a lot about Ken Russell because Hugh Grant, of course, is in The Lair of the White Worm, which one of my favorite horror films. Really early Hugh Grant, I would imagine.
I think it's like his second feature. I think it's like real
early. I think
it's
before Four Weddings and a Funeral. Yeah. Man, the stories, I won't spoil, but the stories that Grant very respectfully told about Ken Russell, who by the 90s was a complete drunkard and abusive and not a great dude.
Kicked off Celebrity Big Brother, it should be said. He didn't make it a week in the Big Brother house before producers removed him for getting into an altercation.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh,
yeah, we'll let, I mean, I'll let listeners do their own research on Ken Russell. He's no longer with us.
No.
His death was quite controversial. His estate was quite controversial. His legacy is quite controversial. He's a fascinating figure to me. If you are interested in more Ken Russell, I think Cam, you're right. Altered States is a really good place to go. Wonderful sci-fi horror.
I like The Devils, personally.
Oh,
The Devils is
The Devils
my favorite.
Is probably his
I was just
going to
say, The Devils... I have never seen anything like The Devils.
You can definitely dig in. Like, a fascinating one that comes up but doesn't really have an impact anymore is the Twiggy starring version of The Boyfriend was very huge in the 70s.
Okay.
Even though I think it's kind of considered a shrug these days and was critically lambasted in its day. But yeah, you can really dig in. And I mean, we're going to talk more about his early stuff. But he's obsessed with actors and musicians.
Well, it's the kind of people he surrounded himself with. Like, when you think about the very idea of now getting a movie insured, let alone even proposing to make it, of with Keith Moon and Oliver Reed and him all in the same film, you could never get that made. Like, that's insane.
Oh, no. And I mean, the interesting thing is, like I said, he's a guy who was always... Ken Russell never stopped being Ken Russell till the day he died, which is quite fascinating because essentially there was... You can track there was a time when people had money... to be interested in that, and there was a time, like, there was actually two times really, because it's like the 80s and the 70s 60s, but towards the end of his career he just made these movies that were essentially him with a DV cam inviting friends over to his house and making a movie. I watched The Fall of the Louse of Usher, which is one of his later ones, and it's literally just people at his house, and so it's like a guy who is like, listen, I'm never not going to make stuff on my own. I get full control. And the way he decided to get full control was just do it himself at his house. And it's like, it'll be the cheapest thing ever.
Yeah.
I don't care. I just want to do it my way.
He had amazing friends. And that's how Jack Nicholson comes to this film. Because 1975, we have One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Jack Nicholson wins Academy Award. We are going to talk in the next episode on Jack Nicholson in The Passenger. Michelangelo Antonioni, huge film. And Nicholson has a very small, interesting role where I believe it is him singing in this film. Mm-hmm. And he said the reason he wanted to do it was that he found Ken Russell such an interesting figure because he hated half of his films and absolutely was obsessed with the other half and wanted to see what could happen. And I'm just like, oh my God. Like,
so what a boon for Tommy though, because they used the promotional stuff from Jack Nicholson. Like I was looking at,
they went that day purposefully. I think that was, the producers did that. They brought the press on the day, and Jack Nicholson only filmed for like 2 hours too, didn't he? I think
he did like super small role.
Two takes.
Well, and even then in the, like when you look at the like newspaper ads, it's him doing that little smiley half wink eyebrow raise thing. And it's Tommy underneath. And you're like, he's in this for 3 minutes. Yeah. Like it's wild.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, my favorite weird Ken Russell thing is just also being like, I think one of the, you know, the crazy Ken Russell thing is his ability to just move people around. I mean, beyond putting like Keith Moon in for the song that Keith Moon wrote, which is such a weird part, and figuring out that he probably would have been a great actor if we kept up with him. But he also did stuff like he was obsessed with Christopher Lee being the doctor, which eventually is what Jack Nicholson was. But Christopher Lee got stuck shooting Man with a Golden Gun in Thailand. So that's why Jack Nicholson came in very last minute and shot for like an hour one day. But it ended up being this huge boon. So that's, and I think that's all Ken Russell, you know, pulling those weird strings. And Robert Stigwood. I think we've found that if anyone can get people to show up for cocaine when one day on set, it's Robert Stigwood.
Yes, refer to our episode from 1978 on Beatles movies to get that backstory. The Elton John sequence, which I think is probably the only
we haven't even talked about yet.
Yeah, I think it's the only sequence I kind of knew going into this film.
I think it's the only one anyone knows. They know the song because he made the song a mega hit.
Yeah.
It is something. And, you know, this piano, which it's a pinball machine that's transformed into Elton John's piano, is pure Elton John. Like, it's Elton John as himself in a way that I would say is not true of Eric Clapton or Tina Turner or the other musical performances in this. Like, this is Elton John at his height, although he had many heights.
He is literally at his height.
He has platforms on. Yeah, he has these crazy... I think they're PVC or fiberglass made giant boots that are based on a cherry red Doc Martin that the Doc Martin founder eventually bought these shoes, and they're like on display permanently at a museum in England. But I actually thought they were at the Battersea Museum, which I record this podcast a block away from the Battersea Museum. So I was trying to like search their collections, and they have different Elton John boots. But this pinball wizard sequence where you have, you know, members of The Who playing in the background and Elton John in the kind of Roger Daltrey role of singing, it looks incredible. Like, I get it. I get, like, that is to me the synthesis of what Ken Russell was trying to go for. And whether he's successful or not, that sequence is very successful and really defines for me, like, if I have to pick something for 1975, I might pick that sequence to define it.
Oh, yeah.
I want to argue that this film is the pinnacle of rock and roll, of like, period. Yeah. Like, this is where rock and roll kind of ends, because 1975 is a weird year where, like, we talked about disco coming in and it reaching its pinnacle in 78, and in 79 it was gone. But 75 is when it was really starting to take over the airwaves. That's when Jive Talkin' hit, and like, that was just game changing. So there was a musical award show to try and bring rock and roll back called the Rock Music Award that was hosted by Elton John and Diana Ross that year, and they come out on like a bedazzled golf cart onto the stage. Diana Ross is pregnant with her first child, is wearing this giant yellow like Big Bird outfit. Like, it's huge and gorgeous.
I've seen photos of that. That outfit is, I believe, Bob Mackie. People might get mad at me for that being wrong, but I believe it's like a very famous Bob Mackie, Big Bird, Diana Ross mashup.
It's got to be. And he introduces himself as being, "Hi, I'm Captain Fantastic." And then she says, "And I'm General Delivery." And that's how the show opens. And it just gets weirder from there. They were promoting Tommy, so Roger Daltrey and Margaret come out on like a fully glittered out fire truck.
Fire truck.
Like, this thing is bonkers. And they're giving away things called the Rockies. And there's a podium that like lights up like R2-D2. That delivers like the winners, and in the audience are people like Ella Fitzgerald, and you're like, what is going on?
Well, Becky, acid was a lot different back then than it is today.
Well, I also just think that weirdly doing this series has made me realize that there is like because rock is such an amorphous category that I think that there's just like movements in rock history. And I think you're right that there was this, and it's what they're talking about with the death of rock and roll in 1970, whatever, is like, it's a, just a death of a certain style. Because of course there was rock music in the 1980s, but it was a different thing, right? Like when you think of, you know, Poison or whatever, that's not the same.
But this also incorporates different things that are coming to an end. Like you talked about, you know, the disillusionment with gurus, which everybody was into in like the late 60s, early 70s. The Beatles really kind of kicking that off in the mainstream.
Who also famously hated Woodstock. They're like the one band that was like, Woodstock was terrible. What are you talking? Like, they're like, I get, they're like, I hope everybody enjoyed themselves. But they were like, our experience was awful. It was not a good concert. We barely got paid.
When I was watching this, I couldn't help but think of the 1972 documentary Marjo. Have you guys seen this one?
No.
Oh,
no,
guys, go. This is my gift to you. Go watch Marjo. because it is the interviews that were done. Sarah Kernikan is one of the co-directors. I do not remember who her other director was. And they followed around this guy who was the youngest preacher ever. He was 4 years old when he started. And now he's in his, I believe he's in his late 20s, and he's trying to make it in Hollywood. So he basically brings them into all of these different like evangelist meetings and things and shows them all the tricks of how he makes his money on this circuit. It is amazing. And Marjo Gottner eventually would go on to star in a bunch of B movies. Fascinating human being. Mm-hmm. But this documentary really blew open a lot of stuff. It won the Academy Award that year for best documentary. And when I'm watching this, I can't help but think, oh, that they saw this and there's an influence here, because it's all that ending of this spirituality and religion and, you know, blowing the stuff off.
I can see that. Yeah, that's a great point. Well, speaking of spirituality and obsession, should we move to our next film?
I think that's a great idea, Alicia. So our next movie also stars Roger Daltrey and is titled after the phenomenon where a fandom was going bananas over a 19th century composer. Huh, kind of like modern day rock star fandom. Oh, wait, I see what you did there, Ken Russell. Will it throw us into a frenzy? That's coming up right after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Movie props go missing from film sets all the time, and they often turn up in weird places. The Hoggle animatronic from Labyrinth was discovered in a lost airline shipping container in Alabama 18 years after it went missing. The original Death Star model was found in a country music bar called Star World in Missouri, being used as a trash can. My personal favorite is someone stole two fiberglass cows from the set of World War Z in Scotland. They have as of yet to be found, but I'm sure they will have a story to tell when they are once again discovered. So I'd like to think that somewhere out there, squirreled away in a Nana's attic, is the horse-sized penis that Roger Daltrey sits astride as it races towards a spread eagle Sarah Kesterman waiting on the other side of a guillotine. That one day someone will pull out an amorphous red inflatable and expand it on their front lawn during the holiday season, only to discover it is a bouncy castle-esque lady groin clad in red silk panties and fishnets. I personally would have absconded with the bedazzled metronome, which kicks off the timing of the frenzied film you're about to experience. It's a movie whose tagline is it out Tommy's Tommy. Let's talk about Listomania.
I'm gonna say I want the piano key bathrobe that Roger Daltrey is wearing as Franz Liszt. That's kind of my favorite item of this, and I think the most practical, that if you had it,
agreed,
you could work it into your decor and your your everyday wardrobe?
Well, the metronome, I would just like put it like right at the front door, and I'd be like, oh, you just took off your shoes, just place them next to the bedazzled metronome. Like, it would become an immediate thing I'd point out when people walked into my home.
It's a cute one.
Does it not also have a penis on it, though?
Yeah, there's...
I thought that the thing is a penis.
Yeah, the ticker, yeah. The ticker's a penis, yeah. For sure.
Of course it is.
So this is Litzomania we're talking about, which went into production just 2 weeks before Tommy was released. So both of these films are 1975, as we've already stated. If Tommy was, you know, in the top 10, really, really important as an underground midnight film, but also had commercial appeal, Litzomania was the opposite of all of that. Although I do think, and I haven't talked to either Becky or Cam in advance of this, I do think there's merits to this film, but it's less successful. This, for me, is really where Ken Russell meets his most Fellini-esque-ness. I think it's really here in Litzomania. And Litzomania is a real term that was coined, I believe, in the 19th century to describe the unbelievable appeal that the composer Franz Liszt had in the 19th century, that women were fainting at his performances, that, you know, yelling his name, that it was really it wasn't the first time, but one of the first where you had this god, this sort of obsessive, what we would call a rock star, except, you know, 200 years ago.
Beatlemania, the concept is based on Litzomania.
Yeah, which I actually didn't even piece that together. That's interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. But and if we're gonna talk about Beatlemania, well, we've got Ringo Starr in this film as the Pope.
Yes.
So you still have that kind of Catholic obsession that Russell has with idolatry, and you see where he's actually include Russian icons that are actually like the paintings of members of the Who and rock stars. This is loosely based on a kiss and tell book that was written by one of Franz Liszt's lovers, which I kind of love.
Those aren't new at all.
They are not.
They've been around for a long time.
They are not. He was a bit of a Lothario in real life, I would say. Some of his very famous lovers included George Sand, one of my favorite historical figures of all time, Lola Montez, was one of his very famous lovers. And you see bits of these two women, but mostly you see the mother of his children, who he was not married to, who was a countess. And you also see his Russian, kind of evil, hellish other mistress.
I didn't bargain for this!
The bargain was of your own making. I have given you the power of Orpheus, the power to make music to soothe the savage beast. You said you would sell your soul for such a gift. Give anything.
And most importantly, his antagonistic relationship / frenemy stuff with Richard Wagner.
Besides being German, Richard has something else in common with Beethoven. He's a bleeding genius. How do I know? You told me so yourself, didn't you, Richard?
Who is played by Paul Nicholas, who you'll remember as Cousin Kevin and Tommy. And it is, I mean, things get kooky. If you thought Tommy was kooky.
Yeah.
And I mean, Becky, you described it best. Giant fiberglass. I'm guessing they use the same fiberglass provider as Elton John's Pinball Wizard boots. Giant penis being thrust in hell through a guillotine with all these women, all his lovers, ready to chop off the tip of his penis while Roger Daltrey as Liszt is just screaming no.
Like, it's... What about the room full of gas-spewing asses? Like, they're all mounted on the wall. Like, this just is wild.
Yeah.
I wonder, Elton John demanded to keep the boots as a part of why he agreed to the movie, so I wonder if Roger Daltrey kept the penis.
Yeah.
It's gotta be somewhere. And all those, like, dick plinths and, like, columns, like, it's that's gotta be in someone's living room.
I keep picturing the hormone monster from Badmouth, and this might be his favorite film.
This movie is crazy because it's almost as high budget seeming as Tommy, and probably, again, you're right, it's probably one of his most expensive movies, and yet it's so much weirder because it's just pure Ken Russell. It's based on a 54-page script, which is crazy.
Yeah, there was no script.
It's prog rock. It's mostly the composer is the guy from Yes, Rick Wakeman.
Rick Wakeman, who also plays Thor.
Look at my creation, Franz. Isn't he superb? Such power, such majesty, such grace.
And the parallels to Rocky, too. The fact that this came out in the same year as Rocky, and there's like an Ultraman and he's trying to build that. I mean, we're going to get into the Nazi stuff in a minute, but it's very similar to Rocky Horror.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, I didn't think of that either. But yes, it's this horny, weirdly. Well,
this is definitely where, because Ken Russell's also been called the great vulgarian of cinema. And I'm like, if you had to pick his most vulgar film... It's probably not The Devils. It's probably this, for the reason.
Part of me also wonders, like, there might be a more vulgar one. I haven't seen Ken Russell's that kind of director. Yeah,
I haven't seen all of Ken Russell. I love when Liszt is playing. You see him playing for the first time at the concert, and all the women are going insane, and they just start chanting, "Chopsticks, chopsticks, chopsticks."
Yes, that part is.
Because I didn't know the origin of chopsticks. Like, as a child, even if you don't know how to play piano, you know how to do chopsticks. And to see that in this film made me laugh so much.
There's so many references, you're right, to like body stuff. And I mean, there's fascinating things to know. He originally wanted Marty Feldman to play Wagner, which is kind of a fascinating difference. But you get the idea of how maybe wacky it could have even been.
Yeah.
And he also has stuff like, I mean, the movie starts like a Carry On movie where he's just kissing a woman's boobs. And I mean, there's so much boob stuff. And then also there's the weird, and I had to look it up because this movie predates the Dukes of Hazzard, and yet it has a Dukes of Hazzard-esque, but it also has the part where it's like, well, looks like Franz Liszt got himself in a mess of trouble. And it's like, that predates Dukes of Hazzard. Did this movie make up Dukes of Hazzard?
I mean, coming back to your point, Becky, on Rocky Horror Picture Show, Little Nell, who plays Columbia, very, very briefly in this as one of his lovers. I think she's completely nude. You don't see her in clothes at any point in this film. But just to, like, you know, really hammer home what Ken Russell's going for, he's casting someone who is super famous for Rocky Horror Picture Show at this point in this film. So, I mean, that is a really good point of connection.
I read an interview with her where she was actually very disappointed because she was so excited that she got a bedroom scene with Roger Daltrey, and he was super distracted because his wife was giving birth that day. And so she didn't really get to talk to him, and he was apparently like in his own little world. And yeah, so she was like, I was really excited.
It's interesting that all the Russian iconography is in this film, because I really think of Ken Russell in this Svengali role and Roger Daltrey as like the poor, you know, Russian countess, the that is like completely like at, because why, what, Roger Daltrey, get your priorities straight. If your wife is giving birth that day, like, you can take tell Rasputin or Svengali that you can take a break for a day.
And I mean, also to know that I read that interview where he seemed, and like the reviewer is like, Roger Daltrey is very much out of his depth and he's just being abused. And then it's like, you want to do another movie immediately? Yes, sir.
and
I mean, as much as we're saying that this is full of nude women and all sorts of body stuff, I mean, both of these movies also sexualize the hell out of I don't think Roger Daltrey has a full shirt on in either of these movies for more than a few minutes. It's like he is very
and
nude.
And it's important to remember
lot.
That like this is, he's someone who would have been on a poster in teenage girls or preteens even's bedrooms. Like, he really was like a heartthrob of the 1970s, beyond being a rock
and roll.
He was
the Franz Liszt of the 1970s.
Exactly.
I also want to be clear that as much as we talk about the excesses of like Keith Moon and Pete Townsend, who were both addicts in different ways, Roger Daltrey was sober for all of this, which
I think
just wild.
I think Pete Townsend was sober by this point too, maybe. His guru is all about, that's partially the Acid Queen stuff, is his guru very much believed that psychedelics would not open your mind. They would actually cut you off from God. So you're like not supposed to do drugs. So unless he was a bad follower of Baba. I don't know.
Yeah, I really loved, and I this sent me down a total rabbit hole, this film.
Sure.
Again, I love Lola Montez, wish she had a bigger role in this. There is a lot of, there's actually a film in the 50s from Max Ophuls called Lola Montez, where Liszt plays a very prominent role. I'd recommend that if anyone's interested in her. But I did not know, and I'm not someone who knows a lot about composers, but I did not know that Liszt's daughter, Cosima, who you see in this film, played by an 18-year-old Veronica Quiglin, who's really good. She looks 12. She's like 12 going on 18.
Yeah.
I didn't know that she left her husband, who was a pretty famous composer, and then married Richard Wagner and became kind of like the controller of his image into the 1940s, long after he died. Like, this was not actually, I didn't know that connection to Richard Wagner and Liszt myself. And this film makes that so interesting. This actress who plays Cosima has this really great line. They're like, I think Wagner has found them, like, they're in Hungary and there's a war. and they're like in a trench and she's got a baby, and they're like, Wagner steals a flask of I think a grain alcohol from her, and she's like,
leave some for baby punk.
And it's just like, that line stayed with me so much. I mean, eventually she's going to leave her husband and marry this man who's stolen her infant's flask. I don't know what's happening, but
yeah, there's a very weird, I will say, the movie is, I think you said before, Ken Russell is obsessed with artists and composers and actors, but specifically he had all these composer movies, and this one is the one that is the least, I think, concerned with history. Like, it tickles your brain to be like, oh, but it's like, yeah, it's about a war between Wagner and Liszt, who traditionally are the two guys on one side of the War of the Romantics. They were buddies, and like, you could be like, this should be about like him versus Strauss or something.
Yeah, but I think this is the point where we should probably bring this in, where so he did have a whole series of composer films that he made. This is the one that killed it. There was intending to be more.
Yes.
Before this,
six more.
Yeah. Before this, he was going to be making one about Gershwin with Al Pacino as Gershwin, which that had to get put on the back burner because Pacino was busy.
I mean, it got put into the fire. He never made another composer movie. No.
But I started watching, I haven't seen Mahler, but I started watching the trailer for it. Mm. And again, here's a whole bunch of Nazi imagery. And this has a ton of Nazi imagery, which makes sense because Wagner was an anti-Semite.
I think that the way that it completely paints him as a Nazi is ahistorical.
Yeah, it's one-dimensional.
Wagner had one weird essay about being anti-Semitic, and I like looked into it because I'm like, I'm pretty sure this is, because number one, very important to say, Wagner died 6 years before Hitler was even born. Wagner was Hitler's favorite, which is a huge thing. There's actually a great, if you're interested in Wagner and Nazism, there's a great documentary by Stephen Fry where he tries to contend with the fact that he is a Jew and he loves Wagner.
Yeah.
And like how much it was. So like, I mean, there's historians that think that Wagner was Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think much like when we talked about with Christopher Columbus, you know, the horrors of Columbus, something like Columbus chopping off indigenous people's hands. It's like, well, they chopped off people's hands in Spain. And the unfortunate thing is Wagner wrote an anti-Semitic essay, and it's like, well, you know who else was anti-Semitic? Franz Liszt, pretty much all the composers.
Yeah, which certainly if we're like, talking about the 19th century, which was the fashion of the time to be anti-Semitic as well. Like, we think of it as very 1930s. It goes far, far, far further than that.
Yeah, but I also think it's like, to tie him specifically to the Nazis is a bit rough, because he predated it. And unfortunately, it's just like Hitler loved him and Hitler drove him into the ground. It's impossible to remove the music of Wagner from Nazism, but I think it's a little rough to be like, he's a Frankenstein Nazi soldier.
Yeah, he becomes, I swear to God, Paul Nicholas as Richard Wagner becomes all at once a Frankenstein monster and actually Hitler, like with the mustache, with the swastika, with it's a pastiche like no other.
And I mean, it's also seemingly jumps to World War II because he's like destroying Berlin
40 years after he's died.
And Liszt is a magic angel in heaven building a Voltron of all his sexual partners. So it's like, I mean, no one is taking this as serious history, to be fair, but I do think it's kind of wild how much it's kind of like, it's their music, it's not them, it's the ideas, which is fun. Don't get me wrong, but you do kind of worry when this has got to be one of the biggest Wagner movies, right?
Outside of like the silent era, I mean, it's the same thing that kind of happens with Fritz Lang, right? Because Hitler really liked Metropolis, or, you know, he also liked Caligari, never verified, right? That's not in writing, ever has that appeared. But like, then it became kind of this myth that these were Nazi films, which they are very much not. And of course, Lang does a number of films using Wagner music. This is all like so intense. It's intense to kind of conceptualize this film. I love the Voltron reference with all his levers forming this.
Do you think it's intended to be a double entendre, the fact that he's flying an organ?
Yes. I think if anything, I'm missing double entendres in this film.
Yeah.
It's wall to wall double entendres. But
too many.
I mean, arguably, this film has too many, I would say. It probably has quadruple entendres also. But yeah, I mean, we talked a bit with the Nazi stuff and the imagery and kind of the obsession with it in the 1970s. There was an interesting, going back, you guys talked about Ilse Schuwolf of the SS, and there was an interesting interview with the star of that where people were kind of like, why did this pop? Why did this make money? Do people not find it repulsive? And she said that the fascinating thing to her was remembering back then that Nazism seemed historical. It seemed like a thing that was gone.
Yeah.
Because this even predates a lot of the kind of rise of the National Front in the UK and skinhead stuff. So there was, to her, she's like, there was a time in the 70s where this seemed like you were dressing up like a pirate or whatever, you know? It seemed like this was a concept that was there and then gone. And she's like, weirdly, in retrospect, that's so hopeful. It's such a nice thought that we thought that Nazism had come and gone, and this is now a thing we could make fun of.
It's kind of hard. I enjoyed watching this film, and Tommy had to watch multiple times because I was like, what the fuck did I just watch? And I feel like I've only watched this once, but I'm probably going to have to watch it again. I do find it hard to watch this particular aspect of this film in 2021, knowing that, oh, how wrong were they? Nazism is very much back, and a political movement that's been approved and followed, and it's hard to watch something. It is, but it also it underscores the point that this is almost a 50-year-old film. You know, we're talking about a half century ago, which is kind of crazy to think rock and roll and the Who are from that era.
I also think that there's kind of this fascinating coming and going of knowledge of the Holocaust. Because, I mean, you talk about in North America that a lot of people, it took Shoah, which is 1985, for a lot of people to, really connect with survivors of the Holocaust and kind of the level of the horrors involved. So I think that sometimes there are eras where, Nazism can be kind of goofy. I mean, I read a thing that made me laugh that apparently Hitler loved Wagner so much that other Nazis hated it. Goebbels' journal is like, friggin' Hitler made us watch another Wagner. Can you imagine your boss forcing you to watch Gotterdammerung? It's like, oh, goddamn it.
We get it. Fafnir is the dragon.
Yeah, cool. The ring makes him disappear. Yeah, I don't know. It's very fascinating. And this is obviously digging too deep, too, because by the time Nazi Frankenstein shows up, you're so sure, great.
It's so Rocky Horror in that moment. So Rocky Horror. This is what I understand. There's no way this could have ever been a commercial midnight hit the way that Rocky Horror was, or the way that Tommy was. There's just too much.
It's worth saying this was number one at the box office for 2 weeks in the United Kingdom.
Okay,
only the United Kingdom. But I think it came out simultaneously with Tommy. Even I think Tommy was still doing quite well. And I would say it's saying it out Tommy's Tommy is not wrong.
I do want to bring us just quickly into David Putnam and Good Times, because apparently this is one of the reasons why this film is as wacky as it is and why it was one of the last movies, because David Putnam was involved with Ken Russell's whole series of composer movies. And then, Alicia, you know what the next movie it was that David Putnam was going to produce?
I am scared to ask. I know his production company is called Good Times, and I'm like, this man did never make a good time. The Devils and scary things like that.
Oh, no, he did. Bugsy Malone. Malone is the very next movie.
And I will say, so you would be fascinated to know, I believe Bugsy Malone is the last one he made with Good Time. And it's interesting because he had this huge fight with Ken Russell. And Ken Russell, I think, seemed to carry a lot of animosity towards David Putnam. And you're a meddling producer. But then David Putnam goes on to produce Chariots of Fire, The Duelists, Local Heroes, The Killing Fields, and The Mission. And it's like, oh yeah, maybe he knew what he was doing, man. Yeah. That guy went on to win God knows how many Oscars.
Oh my God. Bugsy Malone.
Yeah. Those movies are credited with essentially saving the British film industry. They are what created prestige British film throughout the 80s and 90s. So it's like, because I don't think he did a bad job on this. I think this is a fun movie. It's too bad it didn't make the money back. It's too bad that these guys fell out because they, it's a great producer and a great director.
I would love, I this is like such a broken radio, but I would love to see this on the big screen in a proper restoration. It's, I know like we have had this film on Hollywood Suite and it is in seemingly HD, but I mean like a proper restoration. I would love to see this and how this would play very differently than watching this on a computer screen.
Well, the group of people too, as you watch people react to this stuff, being like, hold on, did that just happen? Yeah. Did that just, and it's like a collective fever dream in the audience, and that would be so much fun.
Yeah, you don't want to be alone watching this at 2 p.m. on a Tuesday when that penis goes through a guillotine. You want some people to bounce off of.
All right. I don't think we can top that. So once again, I want to thank our fabulous guest. Yes, Alicia Fletcher. Thank you as always.
Thank you, Becky. I will not be eating baked beans ever again.
I never ate them before. Okay. Not my thing. I want like a three-quarter English breakfast, not a full English breakfast. Cameron Maitland, thank you so much.
Thank you. I guess you can just get baked beans shot at you out of a can.
It just seems so uncomfortable. You'd be finding them in all sorts of places.
All the crevices.
And on that note, join us again next week as we head to Italy to look at a movie that Ebert thought was perhaps the ultimate black comedy. Will we laugh with it, at it, or just stare in horror? That's coming up next week.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.